Hello and welcome. My name is John August.
My name is Craig Mazin.
And you're listening to episode 638 of Script Notes, a podcast about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. Today on the show, you can't handle the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
We'll be talking about lawyer scenes in movies and television with an actual criminal defense attorney to separate the tropes from the truth. And in our bonus segment for premium members, Craig, beach vacations. Is there anything better or anything worse?
There's almost everything is better. Literally everything.
I'm with you there. So we're going to have to find some other third party to argue for beach vacations.
I don't know if we have the right guy for that. I got to be honest with you.
Well, we'll see. First, Craig, we have some important follow-up here about a mistake that you made.
Yes.
The great Julia Turner herself wrote in to say,
as your self-appointed chief journalism correspondent, I am obligated to write in to tell you that Stephen Glass published his fabulism in the New Republic, not the New Yorker. That is how his articles made it through the New Yorker's vaunted fact-checking process, which, in fact, they didn't.
Yeah.
God, I feel terrible. So, confession time. My entire life, I panic whenever I have to reference the New Republic, the New Yorker, or New York Magazine.
100%.
Now, New Yorker is special. Mm-hmm. New Republic is also quite special. New York Magazine is not that special. Yeah. But I panic every time, and I blew it here, and I blew it in the dumbest way because I made a mistake, a fact-checking mistake about a fact-checking story where a guy was making stuff up. So thank you, Julia, for correcting me, and my deepest apologies to the folks at New Yorker who always been very nice to me. And what did I do? I rewarded them by trying to hang Stephen Glass around their neck. I'm sorry about that. It was the New Republic. Craig is shamed.
Yeah. So Julia also sent through this link about this article that Hannah Rosen wrote. So Hannah Rosen was a contemporary of Stephen Glass working at the New Republic. And when the whole scandal broke, she felt blindsided and betrayed. But in this follow-up article, she goes to Los Angeles to meet with him and see what he's done with his life. And she finds him as he's like trying to get the California bar to let him become a lawyer. And so it's all the drama surrounding that. So we'll put a link in the show notes to this really good article by Hannah Rosen that also sort of ties into our main theme here, which is like, you know, what does it mean to be a lawyer and what does the law include?
We should probably get a lawyer to discuss that.
Yeah, we should. I have the perfect person for us.
Oh, do you?
Ken White is a defense attorney and a former federal prosecutor, whose expertise includes criminal justice, free speech rights, and the intricacies of the legal system. He's got this knack for demystifying complex legal topics, which we can witness each week on his podcast, Serious Trouble, which you should definitely subscribe to. And Craig, you and I and many people may already follow him on social media because he's at Pope Hat, or read his blog posts at
PopeHat.com. Yes, and Ken and I have known each other, I think, before the existence of podcasts. It's going on, 21 years or something like that now. Welcome, Ken White.
Well, thank you very much, guys. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Ken, can you talk us through what do you mostly do in your days? So I see you like on social media, you're writing stuff, you're doing your podcast, but what is your actual day job? Who are you representing?
Well, so I have a practice that includes criminal defense in both state and federal courts and a lot of kind of eclectic civil cases. So I really love First Amendment stuff, but, you know, I take all sorts of other civil cases. So it's everything from plaintiffs to defendants, all sorts of subject areas, a lot of stuff. But to answer your question, what do? It's mostly paperwork. So, the demystifying, you know, it says there's a whole lot of paperwork of various kinds. And then there's supervising other people doing paperwork and editing their paperwork. Mm. And then there's asking the client to give you paperwork and then saying, no, that's not right. Do it again. And then there's arguing about paperwork in front of the judge. Mm. So, it's not a job for someone who really wants the outdoors. Yeah. You can be a trial lawyer, but even trial lawyers spend a lot of time not actually in court doing exciting things.
Yeah. I mean, I got to be honest. You were mentioning just before we started that you're about to go into a trial, and I have lots of friends who are attorneys. Trials seem like these things that sometimes occasionally happen, but most of the time, it's like watching baseball. Every now and again, something happens, but it's a lot of stuff in between that is the athletic version of paperwork. So our understanding, in Hollywood at least, of how this all works, I don't recall seeing a ton of paperwork scenes, John.
No.
Do you?
Somehow, in Clueless, one of our favorite movies, there is a lot of paperwork.
Yes.
And she comes in and she helps out with highlighting through the depositions or something.
Which is disturbing.
Yeah.
As a rule of thumb, for every minute that something dramatic is happening, you spent 2 hours at least preparing for it.
But at least those hours earn you money.
Sometimes, yes, sometimes, that is true.
Sometimes.
Now, Ken, we're going to get into scenes in movies and television that involve lawyers and involve the law. But I'm curious, from your side, how much of your decision to become a lawyer was based on sort of seeing it on screen? Like, how much of your early impression of it and sort of your interest in it came from seeing it on screen?
Well, you know, I think I started out just wanting to be a lawyer because my dad was a lawyer and I admired him. He was a trust and estates lawyer for his whole career, and I definitely did not wind up doing that. That was my sense. And then, yeah, stuff like, you know, L.A. Law, which was our era, and movies like To Kill a Mockingbird and things like that, those kind of influenced it. But most of what I learned about what being a lawyer is actually like didn't start happening until I had jobs in college or after law school.
One of the discussions actually prompted having you come on this podcast was, we were talking about Anatomy of the Fall this last year, which was such a great movie and is a French legal courtroom drama. And watching that movie as an American, you're just going crazy. Like, how are they allowed to do this? Like, all these rules and things we're expecting from the American system are just not happening there. And so as we get into lawyer scenes, I guess we should stress that we're really talking about the realities of the U.S. legal system, because stuff's going to be different every place else. So this is not necessarily going to apply to our British listeners, our French listeners, our Australian listeners.
Noticeable lack of wigs, you know. You don't have to wear a wig, do you? I mean, it would be nice if you could, Ken.
No, I do not.
I'm
going in bald these days. Here's the thing, though. Most dramatic presentations of the law are so far from reality that you might as well have them be commentary on the law of France or Burkina Faso or whatever you want to choose, because the delta is not meaningful, because there's such a huge difference between the way it really works and the way you make it work on screen.
So it sounds like we're nailing it over here in Hollywood is what Ken's saying.
That's what he's saying. It's 100%
accurate.
But I'm okay
with that.
Yeah.
I mean, the way I see it is like it's an art form and it's completely different than the medium it's describing. It's like, you know, someone says, how come the movie isn't like my favorite book? I understand, because it's a different medium. The same thing is, if you're going to depict legal stuff, it's a very different medium than a transcript. And so you're going to cut out all the horrible soul-destroying parts.
But Ken, it must be somewhat frustrating when you encounter a new client who has an expectation of like, oh, how this is all going to go, having seen, you know, legal stuff from Hollywood all these years, and then you have to confront them with the reality of what it's really going to be like.
Yes, although often the clients have a better sense by the time they get to me.
Okay.
Because they're recidivists or?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, yeah. The people I represented when I was on the indigent defense panel, people accused of drug crimes, violent crimes, immigration crimes in the federal system, who couldn't afford a lawyer, they understood it. I mean, they'd seen it before and they didn't have any illusions about it. The way people tend to consume it based on what they've seen, it's not so much they have these movie-style expectations about the way the case works. What you'll find is privileged people, affluent people who went to college and grew up in a good neighborhood and have never been in the system before, tend to experience the system as conspiratorial. So they tend to think that this criminal case they brought against me, someone must have it out for me. The DA himself must have it out for me. There's a conspiracy, because I cannot conceive of any other way that I would be treated like this. Whereas, you know, the guy I'm defending in his third bank robbery is, oh, this is exactly the way it works.
Right.
You know, I'm getting ground through the system again.
Yeah.
So it takes a while for people to realize that it's not just that the courtroom isn't exciting as it is on a 42-minute TV show, but that the process is a lot more Kafka-esque. And, you know, it's hard to accept that this is the way they're treating people all the time. In fact, they're probably treating most people worse than you.
And the lawyers that you run into, I'm guessing both working for the state or fellow defense attorneys, are probably nowhere near as interesting, flamboyant, explosive, tricky, articulate as the lawyers we're seeing on television and movies, but perhaps are better served by their paperwork skills.
Well, and let's not leave attractive off.
Oh,
that
yes,
list,
yes.
Okay.
Lots of Tom Cruises moving through the courtroom.
Exactly. So, 8 out of 10 criminal defense attorneys keep their court jacket in the trunk of their car and look like it. Yeah, there are a lot of characters, actually. And I find trial lawyers tend to be more character-ish than people who mostly do paperwork, just because you kind of have to be, and the system kind of guides you to be. There's a lot more regular, this is my job, not every minute is on camera and funny or dramatic than you expect.
All right. So as we start talking through these tropes, I guess we're going to mostly focus on criminal stuff, but point out when there's differences between how criminal and civil case might work for these situations. But let's think about a classic start of any criminal trial or any criminal procedure is that this person has gotten arrested. And so one of the very first things we hear is the Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. Can you talk us through what the realities are of like a person's rights and what a person should be doing, what that person who is arrested should be doing versus what we see them doing in movies and television?
And can I make a prediction?
Please.
Ken is going to say, don't talk to the police.
Yeah, but also don't talk to the FBI.
So don't talk to anyone, really.
Yeah. A lot of my clients are, you know, white collar accused people. Mm-hmm. And so they're in a position where someone comes to the door, knocks and says, hey, you know, we're from the FBI. We just have a few questions. So it's not happening when they're getting arrested. And that's mm-hmm. true for most white collar crime. You first find out there's a problem when people start coming up to you and say, hey, you know, the whole Columbo shtick, which is very accurate, by the way, the way Columbo just makes, I just have this one question. You know, this isn't a big deal. Why would you be worried about me? Totally law enforcement. Law enforcement loves to put you at ease, make you think there's nothing wrong here. You should just talk, but you shouldn't. And whether you're the guy who's just got, you know, arrested a block away from a bank robbery that just happened, or you're the CFO of a publicly traded company whose stock has taken a nosedive and the SEC shows up at your door and they want to ask you a few questions, you know, just over coffee, both times you should shut up and talk to a lawyer because you don't know what's going on. You don't know your known unknowns or unknown unknowns. You probably don't know the law. Mm-hmm. You may not even know if you committed a crime. You probably don't remember all the details of the things because you haven't immersed yourself in them yet. You have not looked through the emails or the documents or that type of thing. So very little good can happen from you saying, I need to talk to my lawyer. Now, the trick here is people think, but if I do that, then they're going to arrest me. Or if I do that, they're going to be suspicious of me. Possibly true, but the truth is that reminds me of that argument, you know, I don't want to wear a seatbelt because if I drive into a lake, I want to be able to get out easily. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of thinking. You're protecting against something that it's a lot less of a risk when you're saying, I don't want to make them mad. The big risk is that they are incredibly good at getting you to say things that are against your best interest. And overwhelmingly, the best thing to do is to shut up.
That's something that I didn't know as a kid until a television show came along, NYPD Blue.
Yeah.
That was the first time I had seen cops complain about people lawyering up. I mean, they basically were giving you a cheat code. All the cops ever complained about was the idea that somebody would lawyer up. We got to get in there and get this guy to talk before he lawyers up. And all I concluded, what else could I conclude from that show other than lawyer up?
That's right. And actually, that's an area where Hollywood in movies or TV gets remarkably close to the way it really is. So all those depictions and all those shows of, you know, the box and you've got the perp in the box, you're going to sweat them. That is actually pretty realistic. All of the different techniques you see, there's probably not quite as much violence anymore as you see portrayed. But all, you know, pretending to be their friend, kind of conning them into talking, all of that is absolutely classic. That's what they do.
Now, at some point, Ken, you are brought in and you are their lawyer. Can you talk us through that first meeting? Because I think that's a very classic scene we're also seeing. It's like the first time the lawyer is talking with their client. The questions of, like, are you meeting them in prison or in jail? Are you meeting them? What is the boundaries of attorney-client privilege? How much can they feel free to say to you during those moments, even if like, they haven't specifically hired you at that moment? So what are that first meeting, what are the crucial things that we're seeing or not seeing in scenes?
Sure. And I've done all those circumstances. I've met him the first time in jail. I've met him by the phone or Zoom, in person, all those things. If they are consulting me to consider hiring me, then our communications are privileged. I can't reveal them. There are very few exceptions. One being like if they, you know, they're currently controlling a bomb that's about to go off, so something on that level, right? They're imminently about to commit a violent crime. other than that, it's completely privileged. And you obviously have to be very careful about your location. You don't want to be talking in a crowded restaurant. You have to be careful who's in the room with you, because that can disrupt the privilege if there are other people in the room with you. You don't want to be someplace where you can be overheard. But generally, my message is always, okay, I need you to tell me everything that happened. I need you to tell me the whole truth. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start slow, but that's absolutely key. And that's controversial. And that's, you know, you see this all the time in TV and movies. They say, well, don't tell me yet what happened because I want to, you know, the implication being I want to be able to lie for you. So there is a rule that as an attorney, you can't put anyone on the stand to lie. You cannot knowingly solicit perjury. So if the client tells me I was in France, I can't put them on and instruct them to testify I was in Mexico, something like that, yeah. Right? But that problem is vanishingly small compared to the problem of not knowing all the true facts. So most cases settle. Of the ones that go to trial, few criminal cases have defendants testify. I would say less than 20%. So to be deliberately telling your client not to fully inform you of the full facts because of this tiny chance that someday you may want them to testify at trial and say something different is a complete misreading of the situation.
You're going to want your client to say, yeah, I absolutely murdered my wife. You kind of need to know that.
I do.
And the other question I have in regards to this first meeting, it's very typical in television and movies when the defense attorney, if the defense attorney is either the hero or the villain, when they show up, they have this attitude. They always have this attitude when they walk in, like, okay, stupid cops, beat it. I'm here. When you show up in jail, at the police station, wherever you may be, if you are interrupting that process, how do you deal with the police knowing that they're looking at you with either suspicion or frustration?
Yeah, my favorite iteration of that is probably from Fish Called Wanda. But generally, when you meet with the client, you get put in a separate room. You get put someplace where you can consult in private. Generally, you can rely that those are not being recorded in there, although some types of crime, some types of things, I would not have the full conversation there. There's rarely that sort of cinematic, the cops are glaring at you. Usually you're not dealing with the cops who investigated and arrested. You're dealing with sheriff's deputies who are working in the jail or something like that. And so that type of thing doesn't often happen. The time when it sometimes happens is when you get a call and, like, you know, your client's business is being searched by the FBI and, you know, they're sitting out on the curb and then you roll up and, you know, the agents are all around and then it can be a little awkward. But, you know, it's the job.
The other scene I can picture is this guy comes home, his wife is murdered on the floor. He calls his lawyer first and then calls the police. So basically the lawyer is there at the actual crime scene when the crime is first being investigated. Is that a thing that actually really happens? That where someone would call the attorney before calling the police?
In a manner of speaking. I mean, I haven't encountered that, you know, in a murder scenario. But all the time in white-collar cases, you encounter, are we going to go to the cops with this? Are we going to self-disclose that we've just discovered that our COO has been cheating customers or something like that? That is a very common strategic question faced by attorneys. Do you kind of self-report and hope to get out the best? I value clients who call me and let me know something is going badly at the first available opportunity. And unfortunately, all these good decisions I'm suggesting that people make are not the norm, even for really smart people. So, you know, I had a client in here the other day who said, they asked to talk to me, but I said, I need to talk with my attorney. And they say, you sure? We just want to clear some of the things up. And I said, yes, I'm sure, but I'll have my attorney talk to you. And I said to him, you know, would it offend you if I said I want to kiss you right on the lips? Because that is so rare and it just warms my heart.
Yeah.
When clients do that, I'm thrilled. Too often, part of what you get when you get the case in criminal cases or civil cases is that the client has already run their mouth or tried to fix things or tried to make things better.
Now you're in
trouble.
It's
made your job harder.
Another thing we see at this stage is sometimes a lawyer taking a case that's outside of their area of expertise. So, like, you have known thing that you're really good at, but like if a difficult real estate deal came, or if, like, if somebody who was a normally a corporate attorney, but there's like suddenly a murder trial.
Let's say you're a guy from Brooklyn who happens to be in the South and your nephew gets pinched for murder.
For example.
And, you know, what do you do then?
Are there rules about what kinds of attorneys can even do what kinds of jobs? Or basically, if you pass the bar, you can do that kind of case?
For the most part, yes. There are a few specialties where you have to be specially licensed, but generally you can blunder in and screw up anybody's life in any field of law. And yeah, I am very careful about not taking on areas of law that I don't know. And I will tell clients, well, if you want to do that, you're going to have to pay me to learn the law in this area. And I don't think you want to do that. Because I've seen how people going in not doing what they're doing can be dramatically bad. And, you know, having experience both in federal and state court, for instance, I've seen how, you know, competent, experienced state criminal defense attorneys wander into federal court and it's a completely different world and they don't know what they're doing. And they can just cause a complete havoc, very bad for their client. I had a client not long ago who was in some skirmish with a neighbor. They got something from the city attorney's office calling for them to come in for an office meeting to talk about it. Now, they thought they went to their real estate lawyer who thought he was smart, says, ignore it. You would never talk to them. Real estate lawyer doesn't know that an office meeting is a city attorney thing where they basically mean, come in, we're going to have you shake hands, and we're going to send you off and dismiss it. And so instead, he got charged. Because he didn't go to the office meeting. So you got to know what you're doing. You have an ethical obligation to be reasonably competent at the area where you're practicing. And criminal is one of the areas where you can make things much worse very quickly. So I'm very much against people blundering where they do not belong.
So,
yeah.
So no, my cousin Vinny for Ken. He's ruining movies.
But he also, he's foreclosing the possibility of a great television show. Hear me out. Do you remember those wonderful shows where itinerant heroes would just wander peripatetically from place to place? And
BJ and the Bear.
Yeah. Highway to Heaven, Kung Fu. They would roam the earth like dinosaurs.
Oh, Reacher does the same thing today.
Actually, Reacher does, although he kind of, it's like a season, limited, right? Yeah. Like, it's not week to week. Like, Highway to Heaven, he would literally be like, I'm done. The Incredible Hulk.
Totally.
So my idea is that kind of show, but with a bumbling lawyer. So every week he wanders into a new town, encounters a new case that he is completely unqualified for.
I love it.
Blows it completely, and then he's like, did it again, and just moves on. Ken, any chance that
I can see it work as a farce? I love My Cousin Vinny. It's a great legal movie because it's entertaining. It gets some things surprisingly right. Some of the expert cross-examination stuff they show law students. Was it a good idea for this dude who had never done a trial before to do a criminal trial? It was absolutely not a good idea.
Well, except hold on a second, because his beautiful girlfriend understood about positraction. So that part worked.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, you're not going to have Marissa Tomei with you when you're looking to step into a case in there.
You probably won't have Marissa Tomei. I guess that's true.
Ken, you brought up ethical issues. Can we talk about conflict of interest? Because you taking on a certain client, you have to disclose your conflicts of interest there. And what might those conflicts be?
Sure. So a few of them are you can't represent people in the same case where their interests conflict. Unless you have a knowing, intelligent, written waiver from them. So typically, you're not allowed to represent two defendants in the same trial because they may want to point the finger at each other. It's very rare for you to be able to do that. In civil cases, it's much more common to represent multiple defendants in the same case, but you always have to get an elaborate waiver from them saying, I understand all these risks and downsides. There can be problems where someone wants me to sue a former client, which I won't do. And generally, you can't represent one client against another current or former client if you might have gotten relevant secret information from that former client. There are all sorts of rules like that. You can't, when you have a personal financial stake in what's going on, you can't do it. There are often ways to get waivers from clients. Sometimes there's not, and the judge gets to make the ultimate call about whether or not it's right. So it's something you really have to watch out for. And when you have a sort of harmonious group of people who want to hire you, and obviously they want to hire one lawyer, not pay for five lawyers for the five of them, things can go south very quickly when they stop being harmonious. So when that group gets angry at each other, then all of a sudden you're hoping that you did the conflict waivers right.
So the collection of ding-dongs around Donald Trump constantly backbiting at each other, and what a wonderful clown party that is to watch. But the other conflict of interest that we tend to see in movies and television are lawyers sleeping with each other.
I was going to say, like, is it a conflict of interest if you fell in love with your client?
Or the client. Oh, God.
First of all, you. Second of all.
That's just based on your client.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Like, you don't have Sharon Stone as your client?
Right. Yeah.
No, but believe me, you could have the most attractive client in the world and spend an hour talking to them and you may not want to sleep with anyone ever again. Most state bars have rules about carrying on romantic relationships with clients. It's sometimes not classified as a conflict of interest issue, although it could be, but it's generally in most states now considered unethical and improper because it clouds your judgment. They can't make the right decisions about whether or not to get a new lawyer. Their judgment is clouded. So, but of course, it's a trope in fiction forever, and that's because it does happen, and you see it, and it quite often winds up very badly.
Mm. I want to circle back to this idea of representing multiple parties, because I think to Succession, as the Roy family starts suing each other, one of the things that comes up again and again is like, are you going to join this bigger group or have your own lawyer? And the smart people seem to have their own lawyer.
Yeah, because particularly if you're the weakest person in the group.
Yeah.
So like if the corporation is in the face of a criminal investigation and they hire one lawyer to represent the CEO, the CFO, and Jimmy the janitor. Jimmy may take it in the shorts because most of the attention is not going to be given to him. And he has a reason to worry that they're not going to be looking out for his best interests or alerting him when a real conflict of interest comes up. There are always problems in situations where there are all sorts of conflicting loyalties and things like that. And that's why you have to very carefully analyze who the clients are, what the relationship is, to what extent are they going to want to like point the finger at each other to defend themselves in this case, and how can we deal with that? And that comes with very frank, early conversations with clients, which is difficult because, and this is something we should talk about, clients lie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's get into that, because that's also a trope of these stories, is that like, the lawyer, very deep into how it all goes, realizes there's a whole separate thing that they've not been
like
told
Richard
about.
Gere shows up and he's like, what about the book,
you
know, and the videotape and all that. And then,
or Edward Norton is actually a psychopath.
Right. And then, well, Edward Norton, he didn't do anything wrong. And then he did.
And then he did.
But you catch your client in a lie. What is that? Is that a confrontation? Does it get sparky?
It can. It depends on the nature of the lie. So the thing is, clients lie not because clients are bad or because these are evil people involved in crime and civil disputes. Clients lie because people lie. People particularly lie when they're scared and under stress and upset. And so the people I meet are scared and under stress and upset. They're often embarrassed to humiliated by what's happened. They're trying to figure it out, what's going on. They're trying to wrap their mind around it. And it takes a while for them to get a comfort level with you so they'll come completely clean. I mean, think about it. How many people do we all really be completely transparent and, you know, nakedly open with about things? Probably a lot of the time, not even our spouses or best friends or confessors or whoever. It's not human nature. So it can take a lot of work to get to the point where the client is comfortable doing that. Some of them never get all the way comfortable. Some of them can't admit out loud they've done something. And sometimes they lie and it causes me problems. So I've had clients lie up and down after I've given them the whole speech for hours. And, you know, it's had bad impact on the case. I've had clients lie in the first meeting and I found out an hour after I left and I fired them. So just because I didn't want to deal with it.
Yep.
So every attorney knows this, and I represent humans in bad positions, and people like that take a while to get around to being able to tell me the truth.
Circling back to the article from the New Republic that Julia Turner sent through, one of the things that's interesting is, so Stephen Glass was working as a paralegal, and one of his jobs was, as new clients came in, he was the person who sort of first talked them through sort of, this is how it's all going to go. And so he fully disclosed, like, I was fired for doing this terrible thing where I made up all this stuff and I lied. And so he spends like a lot of time explaining how he lied and how it was a bad thing, and in the belief that it actually got the clients to sort of just be more open and transparent about what stuff was actually happening. That's also his point of view on the whole thing. So he may be doing some fabulism right there.
Possibly.
But your ideal client would just sit down with you from the first meeting and say, like, here is everything and I'm holding nothing back, correct?
My idea is that anything that's remotely complicated, that it's going to take a lot of meetings. And I'm going to set the table with the first meeting by explaining how important this is and going through some stuff. And then we're going to go through it in more detail. And I'm going to take the measure of the client. And this is something, you know, you learn over the course of this career over decades. Take a sense of them, how long it's going to take to sort of, you know, romance the truth out of them. And sometimes I guess right, sometimes I guess wrong. But the things you see in movies and TV, it's very classic. It's almost a cliche, I think, where, you know, the defendant has told them some of it, but then there's one aspect they haven't told them. They say, I was embarrassed. I thought you wouldn't believe me. That's very real. So that happens frequently where they've told me 80% of it, but not the other 20% or something like that. And that's, again, just human nature.
All right. So in this initial set of things and sort of what, before we get to any trial or any sort of settlement, could talk through some possible ways, like escape hatches. So spousal privilege, like the idea that you cannot be forced to testify against your spouse, is that a real thing? Like what are the edges of that? Because you see this in movies and TV.
Yeah, this is a great bar exam question. So there are two spousal related privileges. One is a spousal communications privilege. That means I can prevent my wife from testifying about a confidential communication we had during the course of our marriage. The other is the testimonial privilege, and that's my wife can't be compelled to testify against me while we're married. Not that she would need to be.
She could choose it, though.
Exactly. She can absolutely
Certainly your wife
it.
Would.
Yeah, they would have to say, no, you've testified enough, Ms. Harvard, that's enough.
Please sit down.
So those are real things. Mm-hmm. And they actually do come up all the time. And they come up in contexts like, you know, taking the deposition of a husband or wife and asking them about something that their spouse said to them. That can be under the privilege, things like that. So those are real things. And those come up. Those are usually evidentiary issues that come up at trial or during the discovery process.
Now, you bring up evidentiary issues. And so one of the things we also see in movies and TV is where the attorney or Matlock's assistant sort of goes out and like does some digging around and finds out the truth and does some investigation. How much investigation, discovery, and evidence gathering is actually typical and allowed and commonplace in the kinds of cases that you're taking?
My types of cases, quite a lot. Now, in criminal cases, you're supposed to be getting discovery from the government. Yeah. They're supposed to be turning over stuff. But you will definitely do your own supplemental investigation, whether it's having people interviewed or, you know, researching records or whatever it is, depending on the nature of the case. And I learned very early on how important that was. A very early case I had when I got out of the government was a young guy who had been arrested while doing a summer at a prestigious college. And he gets arrested for having meth and a gun in a drawer in his bureau in the college dorm room. And he says, oh, it's not mine. And, you know, someone must have put it there. And I'm like, yeah, sure, kid. But I hire an investigator to investigate the roommate because the parents have the money to do this. Come to find out the roommate just got out of jail for stealing things from other people at this prestigious college and blaming it on other people, trying to finger other people for the crimes.
Hold on.
I went and I used that information because this guy who did that was the one who turned my client into the police, said, look what I found in the drawer in the bureau. So I brought that to the DA and I said, you know, your witness is probably going to be take the fifth, but I'm going to make mincemeat of him. So they wound up giving my client a deal, a diversion program, stay out of trouble for a year, no charges. So that's an example of why you have to learn to investigate things, even if you're dubious, because the thing about these cases in the system is you can get so worn down and so into a rut that you can stop seeing people as individuals, stop believing their stories, just see them sort of as a statistic. I've seen this case a million times before. It always plays out like this. And lose your edge that way. You've got to keep your edge, and you've got to always make the inquiries and put in the work to do that job for your client.
Well, let's talk about who's doing that work. So you said you had an investigator. Is that a private investigator? Is that a person who's like licensed to do that? Or is it someone else who's working for the firm? Who does
it
that?
It depends on the case and the type of law. So typically criminal cases, you know, we have private investigators that we have relationships with. A lot of them are ex-journalists or ex-federal agents, things like that. They're good at wheedling information out of people, that type of thing. You know, there's not a lot of gunplay with them, but there's a lot of tracking people down and talking to them, getting them to talk. We have different investigators for different types. Sometimes they're in-house. Sometimes they're not, but it really depends on the occasion. Civil is often very different because civil discovery is a lot more active. You're sending formal demands to the other side. You're entitled to do things like demand they produce particular documents or answer questions or sit for a deposition. So you have a lot more leeway of how you investigate in a civil case.
So let's say that you've talked to the client, you see what the case is laid out before you, and before you would go to trial, there's some discussion of like reaching a settlement. Are you the person who reaches out with sort of like, hey, let's sit down and talk this through? Like when something comes to a settlement before trial, what's tended to happen?
It very much depends on the type of case and how serious it is. Your run-of-the-mill misdemeanor or sort of petty felony, probably at arraignment, they're going to tell you the offer. So like if you show up on a DUI, they're probably going to tell you this is the standard offer for first offense DUIs. They'll tell you that at the first appearance. Other cases, either you approach the prosecutor or the prosecutor approaches you, say, are you interested? And there's kind of the dance of pretending, no, I'm taking this to trial, but well, just for the sake of argument, what are you offering? It's a lot more formal and complex in federal court. You know, a federal plea agreement is just monstrosity, 20 pages long. It's a lot more informal in state court. But the bottom line is usually one side or the other suggests, can we talk about it? And that's really just a matter of schedule management. So, you know, if you're the prosecutor and you have 20 cases set for trial, you want to figure out which one of them is going to go. And so they're going to want to make inquiries. And if you're a defense lawyer, you know that if someone's going to plead, the earlier they plead and possibly cooperate with the government, the more credit they're going to get, the more lenient sentence they're going to get.
I think we saw out of Georgia was the use of racketeering laws. And so where you're rounding up a bunch of people and you're putting them all together sort of on trial is one big thing.
Ken loves RICO, by the way.
Yeah, loves it. I listen to your podcast. So I know RICO is one of your favorite things on earth.
I like when he says he did a RICO.
But in those situations, like there could be a real benefit to being the first person to turn on the rest of the group. And as the attorney representing that individual person, you're looking at everybody else around you. It feels like there's a prisoner's dilemma aspect to that as well.
Sure, there is. And it's not just RICO or really complicated cases. Any multi-defendant case or any case that's connected to a larger investigation, if you can say, my guy's going to come in and tell you everything and you're the first in the door, then you're going to get the very best deal. And in state court, that means like allowed to plead to the most lenient thing with the most lenient recommendation. And in federal court, it means allowed to plead to a lesser set of charges with a better sentencing recommendation in a more complex way. So the thing is that, there's always a prisoner's dilemma. You know that everyone in the situation is trying to find the least terrible way out of it. And you always decide, you know, who's going to jump. A lot of the time, cases like the one we see in Georgia with Donald Trump and in similar cases, you have what's called joint defense agreements. And those are agreements among the lawyers for the defendant. So what they agree is that I'm going to share information about what I learned from my client about this case and the situation. You're going to share yours, and we all agreed to keep it confidential among ourselves and not disclose it. And if anyone starts to cooperate, then they have to leave the group.
Okay.
And the point of this is to preserve the attorney-client privilege. The idea is that normally the attorney-client privilege only applies to a confidential communication. But the idea is if you talk to a group of people that has an equal obligation to keep it secret, then you haven't taken it outside the circle of privilege. So that's very common. And there, you know, someone will say, well, we're leaving the group. And then you know, oh, okay, they're about to cooperate, something like that. But yeah, all the time. And usually in white collar cases, it's a lot more friendly, collegial, a lot more information is exchanged. Less of that in drug cases, violence cases, things like that. It's a little more cutthroat. But yeah, that type of thing, that type of maneuvering is absolutely real.
So despite your best efforts, there's no ability to reach a negotiated settlement. So talk us through, what are the steps before we get to trial? What kind of things we would see before we get to trial?
So usually when you're getting ready for a trial, you have to put together all the exhibits that you're going to use. You have to have a witness list. Often you're required to propose jury instructions ahead of time. And those are crucial because that's where the judge tells the jury what the relevant law is. You're going to file a trial brief pointing out the legal issues that are going to come up at trial. And probably most crucially, you're going to be filing something called a motion in limine, meaning a limiting motion. That's a motion saying, judge, this piece of evidence is illegal. You should keep it out. This piece of evidence is too inflammatory. You should keep it out. You should let me bring in this piece of evidence. And the motions in limine are incredibly important because they can completely shape how the trial goes by what evidence is allowed to come in and what evidence isn't allowed to come in. So before you're picking that jury, we've elided, you know, tons of work that's very paperwork intensive, very boring to show on film, but actually has a huge influence on how the case comes out.
So now let's talk about, okay, so you've gone through all of the evidentiary hearings, you've figured out sort of what stuff's going to get eliminated. Can you talk us through the jury selection process? Like, what is that actually like? What do we see on film versus what the reality is?
It can go anywhere from super simple to super complicated. Mm-hmm. There are judges, particularly in simple cases, who do it lightning fast. The judges do all the questioning themselves, don't let the lawyers talk to the jurors. And, you know, I've known judges where you can have a jury picked in, half a day. There are other cases, particularly cases that are going to be super long or complicated, where you might have to do preliminary work. You might have to do something called qualify the jury. So this RICO case against Trump and his pals in Georgia is such a one. Jurors are going to get questionnaires saying, hey, would you be available for the next 9 to 12 months to sit in uncomfortable chairs?
Yes. Is it for RICO? Then yes.
And also, you know, have you ever heard of Donald Trump? Do you have opinions about him? That type of thing.
So
bigger, more complicated cases, there will be sort of screening of the jurors. Then there's disputes over who gets to ask questions of the jurors. Some judges want to do it all themselves because when we lawyers do it, and it's called voir dire, we're really doing two things. One is we are questioning the juror to find out whether they think they're a good juror or not. But another is we're developing a rapport with them and showing them themes of our case. Like, well, ma'am, would you agree that if someone is standing there and a guy runs up with a knife that he might think he's danger and might have to defend himself? Would you think that's the reason? That type of thing, right? You're trotting out your themes. You're starting to get them thinking about who the people in the cases are. And you're making yourself hopefully entertaining or at least palatable to the jury. So then you just go through and, different courtrooms have different ways of doing it. But generally, they're jurors that you ask the judge to get rid of for cause, meaning the judge strikes them because there's some legal cause they shouldn't be a juror, like they really can't speak English well, or, you know, they said that my dad's a cop, I couldn't be fair, something like that. Mm-hmm. And then you generally have what are called peremptory challenges, which are challenges that you get to use in your discretion to knock people out. You're not allowed to use them based on race or gender or prohibited characteristics like that, notwithstanding that, of course, it happens all the time, particularly from the government. You're using your sensibility. Who's going to be a good juror for me? Who's not? If you're a prosecutor or if you're the defendant in a case where the plaintiff is asking for a lot of money, you know, you want a solid citizen, someone who doesn't believe in handing out money, someone who works for their money, someone who's, you know, respectable, somewhat conservative, that type of thing. And if you're the defendant in the criminal case or the plaintiff in the case, it's the other way around. So you're looking for people, and it's totally an art and not a science. And there are all sorts of shows about how it's a science, and you can attach electrodes to them and stuff like that and do it scientifically. And my wife watches some of those, and I'm not allowed to be in the same room because it agitates me almost as much as NCIS. I'm not allowed to be in the same room because of the comments I make. So,
because what you're seeing is just like that, it does not reflect reality at all in terms of like the ability to sort of micro slice who these people are.
No. And there are people who make tons of money doing it, but I am super skeptical of that. I think it's dowsing, basically. I think it's flim-flam. Yeah.
So what was that? There was an entire movie about, was it Rainmaker or something like that? It was the Coppola movie where it was like an expert to figure out exactly who should be on the jury using their mind powers. And yeah, how could you, I mean, basically you're just getting people that said that they would be available for 9 months. There are certain things we can all conclude.
Yes. Maybe a speed round here. I want to talk a little bit about courtroom etiquette because there's things we see a lot in movies and television. Talk to us about I object. Talk to us about objections and talking over objections. What does object mean and what are the edges of the reality of objection?
So there's a sliding scale of the formality of objections. The low end is like a local state court and the high end is federal court. Mm-hmm. So to do it properly, I always do it as if I'm in federal court because then I can't screw up. Yeah. To do it properly, you stand up, you say objection, and then briefly the basis, hearsay, and the judge rules. What you're not supposed to do is say it from a seated position. You're not supposed to go off
objection.
On a speech.
Objection.
He knows he can't do that. Since the beginning of time, laws, that's a speaking objection. You're supposed to do it briefly. It's a rule often broken. And you're not supposed to make a lot of bogus objections just to throw somebody off. And judges will eventually call you on that. And the jury will see
it. Has a judge ever said to you, "I'll allow it, but watch yourself, counselor"? That seems to be in literally everything. Yeah, judges are constantly allowing objections, but saying, "But I've got my eye on you." Is that a thing?
If they were going to say something like that, it would probably be at a sidebar outside the hearing of the jury. And that's something that does happen. But no, they don't put it like that in front of the jury. They might say, "I'll let you ask a couple of questions, but get to the point quickly." Right. Something
more
like
that. Where are you
going
with this?
Something that frustrates Craig and I, is begging the question actually a legitimate objection? If someone says objection, begging the question?
It is not a legal objection. I think
it's a mistake of thought.
Yeah.
States facts not in evidence might be the right. Yeah. I mean, let's face it, 90% of the people use begging the question wrong anyway.
90% is a very low estimate.
You know, I discovered to my dismay, having been married for like nearly 30 years now, that being able to use begging the question correctly drives literary people wild. If I had known this in my early 20s, it would have been a completely different social scene for me.
Oh, absolutely. No question. Yeah, it's a very narrow group of people.
Right.
Very curious group of people. Peter Sagal over there at NPR's, I think, is the king of the movement.
Yeah. Here's a question for you.
Yeah.
I see in movies and TV where the attorney seems to be addressing the jury rather than addressing whoever's on the stand. That's a no-no, correct?
Unless it's a opening or closing statement,
right.
Correct. You're not supposed to address the jury, and the judge will yell at you if you do that sort of thing.
What about that sly look over to the jury?
Yeah.
Are you allowed to do that?
The thing is, you want to be careful about that because you might not be as irresistible to the jury as you think you are. So one of my partners did a trial against the SEC, and about midway through the trial, the jury sends out a note saying, "Can you ask the lawyer for the SEC to stop looking at us? He's creeping us out."
Oh, man.
Kind of sunk in his chair for the rest of the trial. It was a bit of a blow to his ego.
Yeah.
You want to be careful with that. But yeah, I mean, if I'm cross-examining something and they're being really argumentative or not asking the question, I will mug a little bit for the jury. I'll roll my eyes and look in their direction, make eye contact, that type of thing. But you want to do it sparingly.
A thing we see in movies and TV is forceful gavel banging, where the judge is banging to get people to shut up or stuff. Is that a thing you've encountered in your real life?
The only time I've seen gavels used is to open a session. I've had judges pound on the bench on one memorable occasion to punctuate, "Mr. White, no, you may not." it's pretty rare. Judges will yell, but, you know, banging on things, that type of theatrics, not so much anymore.
You brought up sidebar. So tell us, like, what conversations should be happening in sidebar that probably too often in our scenes are happening in front of the jury and everybody else?
So stuff that is not clear whether it's admissible or not, and it might be prejudicial. Let's say that we're in a trial and the attorney questioning the witness starts getting into an issue of whether they're having an affair, and it has nothing to do with the subject matter of the case. You would ask to speak at sidebar because you want to spell out to the jury, oh, yeah, we don't want you guys to know about the client having an affair because you might treat them badly. So things like that where the judge may decide the jury shouldn't hear about this are typically done at sidebar. And all sidebar really is kind of a mechanism to keep things going because it takes forever to troop the jury in and out of the jury box. Yeah. And so you don't want to send them all back into the room because then you waste 15 minutes. So
you should try directing a scene with 100 extras, my friend.
Yeah, I'm sure. They're probably better behaved than jurors. But yeah, so it's a way to do things, and it frustrates jurors, I think. And you, again, you don't want to be constantly going up to sidebar because the judge will start just telling you no. Mm-hmm. You got to use it sparingly.
Great. All right. So we're in trial. One of the cliches that we see is people who decide to represent themselves at trial, which I'm sure for you is terrifying. But what are the realities? Like, if I got accused of a crime, I'm allowed to do that, right? Even if I don't have any background in the law.
You are. And actually, it's kind of tricky because the judge has to give you a sufficiently full explanation of why it's really stupid to do that. Mm-hmm. And if the judge doesn't, you might have an appeal later. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how stupid it was. But the judge can't prevent you from doing it unless the judge finds basically that you don't understand what you're doing or not competent or something like that. So it's kind of a threading the needle for the judge. It's almost always horrific for the person. I've heard it described as a slow plea. I mean, this isn't rocket science, what I do, but there's a lot of things to it. You got to know how to do it. You got to have learned how to do it. If you're just throwing it in, you don't know the jargon, and there's lots of jargon. You don't know the rules. You don't know, you know, just getting something into evidence, understanding what it means to lay a foundation for a piece of evidence so that it can be admitted into evidence is something that you have to learn. And so it's generally terrible, and usually people wind up making things much worse.
So let's say we're in trial now and you're going to have witnesses up on the stand. You might have your own client, which for good reasons, you probably won't put your client on the stand, but you might. There may be other witnesses that you're going to be putting up there. What kind of preparation can you do with a witness? Are you allowed to do with a witness? If it's your client and versus if it's somebody else, what are the edges of what you're allowed to do there in terms of getting them ready for it? There's limits to how much you can coach them.
Let's take non-clients first.
Right.
You can absolutely talk to nine clients unless they're represented by a different attorney. Mm-hmm. You can ask them questions. You can say, do you mind if we go through the questions I'm going to ask you? You might even use the word practice, depending on how friendly they are. You can go through. You can ask them, you know, I'm careful. I don't tell them, you know, it would be better if you didn't say that. It would be better if you said this instead. I try to be more subtle and say, let me ask you about that answer. My impression was X, but you're saying Y. Can you explain how I have it wrong? And, you know, they eventually get to maybe they were wrong. They realize they were wrong. They clarify, whatever. So you can't tell them what to say, and you absolutely can't tell them to lie. But there's a fair amount of leeway in going through their testimony in advance, and everyone does it. So you can believe that federal prosecutors, before they put someone on the stand in Sam Bankman-Fried's case, has gone through the questions with that person, you know, 2 to 5 times.
Debate prep.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. With a client, it's different because it's protected by the attorney-client privilege. You cannot put the client on the stand to lie. You cannot knowingly elicit perjured testimony. And that's why that thing we discussed before, there's this trend where some lawyers say that's why you never ask the client what happened and you tell them not to tell you yet so it doesn't prevent you from putting any story on they want. And to me, that's absolutely lunatic because you can't defend them. You can't know what the defense is. You can't organize the case, know where the pitfalls are unless you know what happened and what they know.
That does seem like a terrible strategy, sort of like, look, the deal is we're just going to black box this thing. I'm going to put you on the stand. You're going to say some stuff. That'll probably work. Well, what do I need a lawyer for?
Well, the thing is, this is a real thing that some lawyers do. And so I watched a debate that turned into basically a screaming match between Alan Dershowitz and a different professor 30 years ago in the trial skills class I took, where they were arguing over this very thing. whether or not you stop the client from blurting out stuff, prevent them from locking themselves in. And this is one of the few times where I'm on Dershowitz's side. It's lunacy not to get every piece of information you can get out of the client. And the downside of not being able to get them to lie is comparatively extremely minor.
So let's talk about witnesses. So prosecution and defense are both going to, I guess, provide a list of the witnesses they're going to bring so that both sides can prepare. But in movies and TV, we're constantly seeing surprise witnesses, like the person like, oh my God, this person, you know, we thought was dead, but is now coming to sit on the stand. What are the rules around witnesses who were not previously, you know, announced and scheduled?
So generally that doesn't happen. It's rare for it to happen. It's rare to find out that someone you didn't know before, because usually, especially civil cases, okay, in civil cases, you've had years of written discovery where each side has been telling the other, name every person in the universe who has knowledge about this case. And then you've decided to depose them or not. And then you've made a witness list for trial and all this sort of thing. So showing up and saying, oh, I've got a new guy, usually is not going to go over well. There's going to have to be some pretty convincing reason that you could not have found them before for the judge to let that happen. And the more important they are, the more that is the case. Same with evidence. Unless you can really show you couldn't have found it without due diligence earlier, then it's going to be very hard to get it in at trial. Now, one way that it can happen is if the other side reveals something for the first time, then you're allowed to rebut. So the things about disclosing evidence generally don't prevent you from keeping a few things back for your rebuttal case. If the other side has lied, as they often do, you know, calling them out as liars. That's tricky, and you might not get the opportunity to do it, but that is not uncommon.
So we're talking about witnesses and evidence, but sometimes in films and TV, the lawyer themselves is demonstrating something to the jury. It could be as part of the closing argument or something else that happens. You mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird. So Atticus Finch throws a glass at Tom to prove that he's left-handed. Is that a thing that could actually happen in real life?
You know, throw glasses in the corner.
Yeah. It could happen, but the judge would blow their stack. So yeah.
You're saying, like, even if you like asked your client to put on some gloves in front of the jury, and
that's
it didn't
different.
Fit.
So yeah. Right. So when Atticus Finch throws that cup, the client catching it in one hand is not testimonial, and the client's not under oath. There's an implicit. Here's how I do things, but it's not under oath and it's not subject to cross-examination. That's why it's inappropriate. Uh-huh. You could get a client who's on the stand to demonstrate something with the judge's permission there, and you can get him to say, yes, I'm left-handed. Judge probably is not going to let you, you know, surprise him in the middle and throw something to him. Generally, anything that looks super cute or gimmicky probably is going to get you yelled at by the judge.
But yelled at by the judge, what is the actual impact of being yelled at by the judge? Is it causing a mistrial? Is he giving jury instructions? Like, what actually happens? What's the consequence?
I love this question because it's so much of what you learn over the course of the practice. You don't want the judge to yell at you in front of the jury because the jury is going to become convinced that you're a bad person, you're doing bad lawyer things, unless the judge is kind of an asshole and the jury gets sympathetic with you. So, you know, once upon a time, I tried a case as a prosecutor where the judge was being super mean to the rookie defense lawyer and yelling at her and beating her up and generally being a bully. And the jury was looking sympathetic to her. And I was thinking, okay, this could go badly. They could not guilty just out of sympathy. So I thought, I was pretty young. I thought, I have an idea. I'll make the judge yell at me too. And this was a judge who was famous for yelling. And I wandered into the well in the center of the courtroom. I spoke from seated position. I called him judge instead of your honor. Before long, he was yelling at both of us. And so then the young public defender comes over and says to me, I know what you're doing. And she steps in. So arguably, this is where it went off the rails a bit. But by the end of the day, the guy was bright purple. And usually you don't want to do that sort of thing. Here's the thing about judges yelling. If it's not in front of the jury and if it's not impacting actual rulings, you've got to learn to deal with it. Judges yell. Judges are human. They deal with a lot of stress. Some of them have personalities. And you want to worry more about the bite than the bark. And when I have young associates I supervise and a judge is getting mean or they're worried the judge is going to get mean, I refer to them to the end of Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, where Brad Pitt's character shoots the Nazi's aide because he's so mad that the Nazis,
you'll be
getting
shot
let
this.
Out.
Nah,
yeah.
Don't be shot. More like chewed out.
I've been chewed out before. Exactly. That's exactly
yeah, I've been
the
chewed
line.
Out before.
I'll be chewed out. I've been chewed out before. At this point, I've been yelled at judges before. And I'll be yelled at judges again. And you know, you just deal with it.
All right. So a trial happens. We've gone through it could be months. It could be short. But ultimately, there's a verdict. And so that verdict becomes the title of many movies. That is the moment of closure for this whole experience. What do you see in movies and TV that get it right? And what are the things that frustrate you about how they get it wrong about verdicts?
Well, they get it right in terms of dramatically. They make it like a good close to the story. In real life, you have appeals. You've got post-trial motions. You know, most times if you win a big civil jury award, the other side is going to file a motion for a new trial, a motion to reduce it, a motion for judgment notwithstanding, blah, 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 blah.
Paperwork.
There's always a lot of paperwork. And we see this with all the stuff in the news right now that Trump is going through, where there are these big judgments and now he's posting bonds so that he can appeal them without being collected on. So sentencing can often be quite dramatic, and usually that does not happen at the time of the verdict. It's another time, and that can be a good moment for drama. It's certainly stomach-wrenching when you're the defense attorney standing next to your client who's going to find out how long they're going to be in jail, and when you worry about what your client's about to say. Because one dramatic part about sentencing is that they always ask the client has a right to allocute, to say something. And this is an absolutely terrifying, piss-in-your-pants moment for the defense attorney, because clients feel, no matter what, if they've been convicted, they feel it's unfair. And if they express that, it goes badly. So I've seen clients, even though they were exquisitely prepared, go from probably they were going to do community service to jail by talking about what a victim they are and all this. So client in that moment can make it much worse. You really have to sit on them and make them not express how they're feeling, because how they're feeling is a victim.
Yeah. So, but I want to be clear here. If they were to confess to the crime or sort of admit guilt in that moment, that is evidence that could be used against them in any sort of future appeal. So they also don't want to say, like, I did it, but just be merciful on me.
Yeah, it wouldn't be used against them in an appeal. The problem is more if they demonstrate lack of contrition or if they make their image in the judge's eyes worse. So if you've pled guilty in particular, you don't want to get up there and suggest you don't think you really did anything wrong because you pled guilty. And like we saw recently, Sam Bankman-Fried's sentencing, the judge found him very sort of not remorseful because of his personality and the way he talks. And that probably contributed somewhat to the sentence.
Ken, as we wrap up here, are there any other aspects of, you know, law as portrayed on film and television that we haven't talked to that you want to make sure that our listeners, who are mostly writers, are aware of?
Sure. So entertainment gets some things right. Mm-hmm. Trial lawyers, criminal lawyers, terrible divorce rates, lots of alcoholism, lots of drug abuse, lots of mental health problems, suicide rate that looks like a Latvian phone number. It's all really terrible. And it's a high-stress job. So when entertainment portrays people as kind of suffering through it, that's actually fairly accurate. There are people out there who are just unflappable and seem to have no problems getting through it. And I always suspect they're just in their office sucking off some huge bong to be that mellow going through this, because it's
killing cats.
It's incredibly stressful. So that part gets right. Gets wrong, objections. Objections are a big part of most legal TV shows and some movies. I would be almost happier if you didn't even try, unless you have a lawyer actually tell you what a real objection is or not, because that's another thing that takes me way out, when it's a completely stupid nonsense objection and the response is completely nonsense. So I would say it would be worth it to ask a lawyer about the objections. And you can still make them dramatic. You can make good ones, but some ones every lawyer watching is going to go, oh, Jesus Christ. And then my wife says, shut up.
I've heard her say that.
Yeah. Ken, thank you so much for all this legal stuff. Let's get to our one cool things. Craig, you have a one cool thing here I see in the workflow.
Yeah, this is really an honor of you, Ken. There is a category of videos that every now and then when I'm feeling a little sad, I turn on and watch because, it makes me feel great. You can find there's hundreds of them compiled all for your enjoyment. Just Google sovereign citizens getting owned. It is so much fun. So are you familiar with the sovereign?
I have no idea what this is.
Sovereign citizens are dipshits who subscribe to a theory that they aren't really people under the law, that the United States as currently constituted is some sort of admiralty or maritime law thing, that they aren't really a person but a corporation, that there's just – it's endless reams of nonsense.
Yeah, yeah.
And inevitably, they will get pulled over for speeding or their tags are expired or they're in court for a misdemeanor, a traffic problem, or something more serious. And they begin this nonsense talk, and it goes so bad for them so quick every single time. There are people who sovereign citizens their way into, like, this cop was going to give you a $25 parking ticket, and now you're tased, and you're going to jail. They're so stupid. And apparently, the one thing about sovereign citizens is they don't watch these videos,
right?
Because if they did, they would stop it. So anyway, if you want to see people representing themselves pro se, being idiots, saying nonsense, having judges roll their eyes and go, I literally don't know what you're talking about, just go ahead and Google sovereign citizens getting owned. It's a joy.
I'll echo Excellent. That. Sovereign citizens, you kind of have to think of them as like really, really committed legal furries. You know, they've got this they've got this persona and they've got the costume and they've got the lingo and they're super into it no matter what consequence it has on them living their lives.
They're so into it. Yeah, they think they know the law and it just and you're seeing somebody reading this and you're like, what are you talking? They like Latin. They love Latin, but they don't know why.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
It's excellent stuff. My one cool thing is something that was very useful for me this past week. It's called LibreOffice. It's a multi-platform sort of app you can find for Windows, for Mac, for everything else that I would never actually use it as a word processor. You could use it as a word processor, but it can just open anything. You can throw like any old file type at it and it seems to be able to open it. So I had these old Right Now files for pitches that I did in the 90s. And it's the only thing I could find that could open it, but it opens it beautifully. So I discovered like, oh, that's right. This is when I was pitching on Highlander in the 90s. Like I can now pull up that old Highlander.
You can finally
pitch.
Read that thing.
Yeah.
Can we do some research? I feel like LibreOffice was one of my one cool things at some point a while ago.
It totally could be. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dig it up. I'm so rarely ahead of the curve. It's almost always that I say something. John's like, that was my one cool thing 2 years ago and you said it was stupid.
Yeah. Craig, my co-host doesn't listen to me either. So, I mean,
there you go. Good company. Yeah.
The book Less, you had recommended it. And then like 3 years later, I recommended it. And we found out it was true.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. But
every now and again.
So LibreOffice, I would never actually use it as my main word processor.
No.
Why would I?
I do remember something like that being like an open source thing just because Microsoft Word is so goddamn annoying.
Yeah.
And I do have a bunch of old files. I don't even know what they are.
Yeah, exactly.
At this point.
And so I throw it on and see if it happens.
Yeah.
The other thing I'm probably most frustrated. I used to use Screenwriter, Movie Magic Screenwriter, and actually a binary format. And
it's dead.
It's dead. Yeah. Yeah. Hard to open.
Gone.
Ken, do you have a one cool thing to share with us?
I do. And obviously your listeners are podcast fans. I'm a huge history podcast buff. I love them.
Yes.
Particularly when I'm commuting or on trips or things like that. And I've just been having a blast with the podcast, The Rest is History. So it's two British historians, one of them named Tom Holland, not the Spider-Man one, the other one, and one of them named Dominic Sandbrook. They have a real great rapport and chemistry. And they are really knowledgeable in a wide variety of things, but they delve into huge range of different historical things. And each podcast is, maybe a half an hour, 40 minutes long, perfect for a commute. Sometimes they do deep dives that are multiple episodes about something like the background of the Titanic or JFK assassination or whatever. But they have a real love for the subject. They have a great way of conveying sort of the similarities between these people in history and us and seeing sort of the common threads. Mm-hmm. And they're great at conveying how the values of historians that have told us about this stuff, how those impact how the story gets told. and why you have to discount some things. Because, you know, you can't listen to the Greeks talk about the Persians because they have all these stereotypes and that overrides everything, stuff like that. But I find it endlessly entertaining. They've got a huge back catalog. And I've been listening to this nonstop on commutes for like 6 months and enjoyed every minute of it.
Absolutely. And while our listeners are adding podcasts to their players, they should be also adding Serious Trouble, the podcast you do with Josh Barrow. Is it every week?
It's, well, 45 weeks a year, roughly.
45 weeks, that sounds good. I find it just terrific. And it's Ken talking through the cases of the day, which has been phenomenal. I've learned so much on your podcast. So
well, thank you.
Everyone take a listen to that.
Thank you.
That is our show for this week. Scripted is produced by Drew Marquardt.
Whoa.
That's edited by Matthew Chilelli. Mm. Outro this week is by Lou Storm Borenstein. If you have an outro, you can send us a link to ask@johnaugust.com. That's also the place where you can send questions. You will find the show notes for this episode and all episodes at johnaugust.com. Also, where you find the transcripts and sign up for our weekly newsletter called Interesting, which has lots of links to things about writing. We have t-shirts and hoodies. They're great. You'll find them at Cotton Bureau. You can sign up to become a premium member at scriptnotes.net. We get all the back episodes and bonus segments, like the one we're about to record on beach vacations. Ken White, an absolute pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, it was a joy to come. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Ken.